day on against the grain. You show up when you weren't called. The call wasn't meant for you, but you show up anyway, and you join with others to disrupt the status quo and even perhaps bring down a regime. James Martel uses a big word, misinterpolation, to describe this phenomenon. He contends that it's a principal way that radical change happens in today's world. I'm CS. The San Francisco State professor joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. A lot of discussion revolves around the question of what we are called upon to do by our nation, by our bosses at work, by family members, and so on. Well, at least as important and interesting a question is, what are we called upon to be? Because if we take the nation state, for example, it's quite apparent that we are called upon to be certain kinds of people, certain kinds of subjects. We are told that we have rights and liberties and privileges, and that a great many of those rights adhere to all people being equal. That's one of the grand promises made by those in power, even though it's all too clear at times that those promises aren't in fact intended for all of us. So then what happens? What happens, for example, when people who aren't the intended recipients of a nation's call respond to that call, act like the call was meant for them, act like they possess, or at least deserve, the rights that the state proclaims are universal? Here we find ourselves at the tip of the iceberg that James Martel calls misinterpolation. Something goes awry when and after the state calls upon its subjects, and the result can be quite radical, can be quite subversive, can undermine or in some cases directly threaten the powers that be. James Martel is a professor of political science at San Francisco State University. His new book is The Misinterpolated Subject. The book includes, among other things, Martel's commentary on the Haitian Revolution, on Ralph Ellison's novel Invisible Man, and on Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me. When James sat down with me recently in studio, our conversation began this way. James, misinterpolation is a big word. So let's start with interpolation, which makes me think of the word appellation, which means name or something you are called. Does interpolation mean something similar?
It definitely does in English. I think in French it has this other, because it comes from Althusser, who is a French theorist, it has this other meaning, which is it usually means something like when the police stop people and talk to them. They use that term, interpeller, which so it has a little bit more of a state aspect to it in French as opposed to in English, where it really just means to call somebody.
And that's the sense of the word that you're using, right? That could we say a paradigmatic example of interpolation is when the police call out to somebody?
Exactly. That's the famous story that Althusser says where a policeman is walking down the street and a pedestrian is across the street and the policeman says, "Hey, you there." And the pedestrian turns around and Althusser says he becomes a subject.
And what does he mean by that?
What he means by that is that person sort of retroactively becomes who they always really were, which is to say a subject of the state. And that we get our identity through this kind of material performances of calling and turning towards the call. It's a way that our subjectivity becomes vested in us and then becomes the person we've always been.
In other words, if you did not turn around and acknowledge the call, "Hey, you there," from the cop, then you would not be a subject, or you would not consider yourself a subject.
Something like that. I mean, it doesn't literally have to happen that way, but I think Judith Butler wrote a lot about this, that we're sort of all invested with this kind of primordial guilt, so that we tend to turn thinking we've been accused of something, and that's sort of why we turn. So we're already a subject in a way, or ready to receive our subjecthood. So it's complicated.
So the French theorist Louis Althusser that you mentioned, how much of what he said about interpolation relies on the fact that the person has recognized that the calling was addressed to him or her?
I think it's very central for Althusser, because that's the experience that you get, that you feel like that he, as Althusser says, it was really me, and he puts really in italics. So there's a sense that you've finally been recognized, that you've gotten the recognition from the state that you've always desired. And that is something that we all apparently crave and need, feel that we need anyway, and that the state provides with us.
Although, of course, with the officer calling you, that seems to have maybe it could have quite a sinister tone to it.
Well, definitely, and that's a problem that a lot of people have with Althusser. Although I should say for the record that there's lots of different ways to read Althusser, but the general way he's read, a lot of people have a problem with this because they say this is terrible. This is a colonization of our subjecthood by the state, and there's nothing that you seem to be able to do about it.
So you write that interpolation establishes and cements authority and social norms. You begin to talk about this, but talk some more about it.
So as I was speaking before, I kind of read interpolation as a kind of a colonization of the self. And the main thing that you're visited by through this is a kind of a sense of a unitary subject, that you are one whole and entire subject. And that's you. That's really you at your core. And that has an enormous number of normative aspects to it. And it varies widely depending on your gender, your race, your class. I mean, all of these things are kind of packaged in or smuggled into this supposedly universal subjectivity that you're receiving from the state. And so you get different kinds of subjectivity and different relationships to the state. And all of that is just swallowed whole in this one seemingly innocent gesture.
All right, so that's interpolation. So then what is misinterpolation?
So misinterpolation is sort of a term that I've been using to speak about when interpolation goes awry. And as I say, Althusser himself sort of suggests this is possible. For example, when he says, 9 times out of 10, the person who turns around is really the one that the police officer meant to call, which he doesn't say this, but my question is, what about the 1 in 10 that wasn't the right person? He also says interpolation hardly ever misses their person, and I ask what happens when they do miss their person. So on the surface of it, misinterpolation is a question of the most obvious cases when clearly the person who was called is the wrong person.
Okay, so there's some disconnect, right, between the calling and then the person who is called or maybe wasn't called and is responding in some way. That's one way to look at it.
Exactly, and the stakes of this are very high because if the idea is that the state gives you your subjectivity and that's really who you are, then just the mere idea that it's possible for the state to make a mistake really challenges the state's power, which is, after all, a power to absolutely know somebody and have perfect knowledge and control over us. So it's really a flaw in this very otherwise seemingly impregnable system.
How often do you think misinterpolation occurs?
Well, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that misinterpolation occurs every time interpolation occurs, which is to say that interpolation never actually knows who you are and never really tells you who you are. It's all a performance of the state's authority. And one of the most important arguments that I make is that interpolation, as Althusser discusses it, is really much more important for the state than it is for the subject. And in fact, the state needs the subject to turn and recognize that the state really knew who they were. And in that way, the state itself is affirmed and given its right to exist. The subject, on the other hand, I agree, doesn't need interpolation at all and doesn't need to be told who they really are because that isn't really who they are and the state doesn't really care who you are. So in a way, I say that the cases of misinterpolation that I focus on are only the most glaringly obvious, so that if we stick to Althusser's idea of 9 times out of 10, the right person turns around, the 1 time out of 10 is only, in my view, the time when the mismatch between what the state thinks you are and who you are is too glaring to paper over. But the other 9 times out of 10 are also cases of misinterpolation, only we misrecognize it, to use Althusser's term.
You focus in this book on liberal capitalism, and we're not talking about liberal as liberal versus conservative, but the liberal worldview. Which brings with it principles like individual agency and autonomy and freedom and rationalism and equality and toleration. Why is liberalism, as you write, highly vulnerable to misinterpolation?
That's a great question. It's because liberalism is the doctrine that has created this kind of universal subject that it claims that we all are. And it bases itself on these universal rights that we all supposedly have access to. And it's on that basis that we are excited to become the subjects of the state, right? Because we feel as such, we have access to all these rights and opportunities and promises. The reason that liberalism is vulnerable, I argue, is that all of these rights and universal subjectivities are not actually universal at all. In fact, they're very, very hierarchical, and they're really targeted towards certain people at the expense of other people. So misinterpretation is hazardous for liberalism because it challenges liberalism's own sense of its own universal truth and its own access to those kinds of identities. By showing that the state can be wrong and can misinterpretate people, it shows that the kind of idea of a universal subjectivity is also possibly wrong, which is fundamental to liberalism and to capitalism.
That's James Martell. He's professor of political science at San Francisco State University. We are talking about his new book, The Misinterpolated Subject. It's published by Duke University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in your book, you give, and I appreciate this, several examples of misinterpolation to show how it actually operates. One of these is the Haitian Revolution at the turn of the 19th century. So this is billed as, you know, the only successful slave revolt in modern history. Remind us of what basically happened, just for people who are not unfamiliar.
So the French Revolution in France, which was the colonial power that owned Haiti and had the slaves and owned the slaves, had a document that came out called the Declarations of the Rights of Man and Citizen that proclaimed, you know, the equality of all human beings and so forth. And somehow this idea, not just the declaration itself, but the kind of the idea of the French Revolution percolated across the Atlantic and seems to have somehow inspired the slaves of Haiti, and in particular their leader Toussaint Louverture, to lay claim to those same rights that they saw being ascribed to Frenchmen and French women. Now, in fact, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen was only really a liberal declaration that they wanted liberal people, rich white people, to have rights and freedoms against the kings and the feudal system of France. And they had no intention of applying it even to the white working class in France, certainly not to women, not to Jews, and absolutely not to black slaves in Haiti. But somehow the Haitians answered that call nonetheless, and in doing so, they managed to actually eject the French and the armies of Napoleon, which at the time was the strongest army in Europe. And even they were invaded by all the capitalists got together, like the Spanish and the Americans and the British, and they all invaded and they kicked everyone out. And yes, it was this kind of miraculous revolution that went on to inspire the French Revolution, because when the white working class in France saw this happening in Haiti, they got inspired too. And then they radicalized their revolution. And then through that, the French Revolution radicalized revolutions all over the world.
So the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, issued in 1789, specifically, what does that declaration say that's relevant for your purposes?
It says that, I forgot the exact language, but it basically says that everyone is equal and free and equally free. And then I think the second clause of it is something like, and the only hierarchies that we will make are for social, practical reasons, which already kind of gives away the fact that they're not planning on having any kind of real meaningful freedom. But this was, again, read in Haiti and other places as pertaining to everyone universally. And one of my arguments that I make in this book is that liberals will often say that the liberal universal is true, and that the problem with the application of liberalism is that you get illiberal people, racists and so forth, who don't want to allow people access to these things, but that liberalism itself and its universal is capacious enough to hold everyone and take care of everyone. And my argument is that liberalism is rotten to the core, that it never intends and never wants anyone but its own elites to have access to these things in the name of universal, and that actually what we see in misinterpolation is kind of a violent insertion of undesired and unwanted people into the same universal rights that they meant to keep only for themselves. So it's really a refutation of liberalism rather than a sort of sense of liberalism working the way it's supposed to.
I see. And in some ways, really, if a government, a state makes a call like that, it kind of maybe needs to expect that it might be misinterpreted, or it might be believed to apply to people who it was not intended to apply to.
That's right. But I think it often comes as a shock to the people that that make these declarations or these kinds of declarations because they're so used to having complete control of the kind of narrative that when these other unintended people show up answering a call that was obviously not meant for them, the kind of the metropole power doesn't really know what to do, doesn't see this coming. And one of the reasons that I say liberalism is particularly susceptible to misinterpretation is it's always making these kinds of calls. It's always believing in its own hype and its own universalism. So there's an endless opportunity for sabotage and for subversion and for things to go wrong because it keeps on speaking this liberal doctrine as if it was true. And then these people show up and then they're kind of stuck with them.
Well, one person who showed up in the case of the Haitian Revolution was Toussaint Louverture, the leader of the Haitian Revolution. And what did he think of the ideology and the universalism expressed in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen?
That's an excellent question. Formally, I think he was all for it and was very, very inspired and excited by the doctrines of the French Revolution. So he proclaimed himself a patriot of France to his last hour and was always very hopeful and appreciative of the way that French ideas had freed him and gave him access to this stuff. There's a way to read him as being more complicated than that, in that you could see that he was sort of using liberal discourse as a way to sort of shove himself into the liberal universal, however uninvited he may have been. And so this might have been a kind of a strategic move on his part. And especially when he was in jail at the end, he was rotting in a jail with Napoleon. And even then he was writing all these letters to Napoleon saying, your generals in Haiti are betraying you. They're trying to reimpose slavery. Surely you, as a bearer of these universal values, understand that this is terrible, et cetera, et cetera. That could have been a strategic move on his part that he really had no alternative but to turn that way. However, there's one piece of evidence that he really did believe in the liberal universal in kind of a not so good way, because after the revolution, or even in the parts of Haiti that were under his control, he retained the plantation system. The Haitians that worked on those plantations were not slaves anymore. They were now paid money, but he didn't let them leave the plantation. So he insisted on keeping a French capitalist colonial relationship going even after he had freedom. And that is not at all what the Haitian slaves themselves wanted or thought they should have.
So then Toussaint did not in fact take away the power of the white French planters class in Haiti in terms of their power over the economy?
No. In fact, he wanted them to stay. And it was a very unpopular decision on his part, and it kind of led to a lot of confusion and a lot of suffering on the part of the Haitians who otherwise venerated him. But it was sort of a sign of the way that he was maybe actually was bought into the liberal system and really was a liberal despite himself. He was a kind of a liberal who just insisted on being liberal when all the signs pointed to the fact that liberalism had no interest in black slaves having any kind of equality.
But it's natural and tempting, isn't it, on his part to believe that or to think that or to want these universal ideals to apply to everybody.
Absolutely. And that's how liberalism works. It's so seductive, you know, and a lot of the stuff I write about in this book are subjects. Fanon, I have a chapter on him and talk about Ralph Ellison and Invisible Man. And it's who doesn't want this? You know, why would anybody want to not be the subject? It's wonderful. You get to be equal. You get this, you get that. And in a way, the more it is different from the way you're actually treated and lived, the more attractive it becomes. So it's really a seduction. And I think it's a seduction that a lot of radical subjects of color really have struggled with, because they feel that seduction even as they are resisting it. And I think that's very much Toussaint's position, that he was very much in a double bind that way. I mean, I think everyone has that version of that, but I think it's more clear with subjects of color because they are so clearly held in a lower tier that for them, there's just no question that they are not the ones who are intended by these calls, but they show up anyway.
All right, you were saying earlier that the masses of ex-slaves in Haiti, they did not share Toussaint's perspective. So, first of all, did they actually hear about the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen? And if so, did they understand it?
C.L.R. James, in his wonderful book, The Black Jacobins, which I recommend to everyone, says that they vaguely understood it. He says that they had sort of reinterpreted the story of the French Revolution, that the white slaves had overthrown their white masters and were now free. And it was kind of they'd kind of made a version of how they understood things. But they got the general gist of it, according to C.L.R. James. And there's lots of stories about people, Haitian rebels, having the document, the actual Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen, in their pockets, you know, when they were killed and stuff. So there's evidence that the doctrine was circulating and people had access to it, if not as a talisman, if not as a kind of an intellectual guide. So I think it did have some effect on them. But I think generally they were much less bought into liberalism and colonialism and imperialism than Toussaint Louverture himself. He also was a slave, but he'd had a much different upbringing. He had been somewhat educated, and he had sort of different access and a different life than many of the slaves that were below him. And they venerated him as this amazing general, but they were very ambivalent, I think, about his own seduction by liberalism.
So tell me more about what the slaves, what the liberated people of Haiti, what they did with this call, which they understood to varying degrees. What did they do that was so interesting to you, and how does that qualify as misinterpretation?
So their response was, I think, much more anarchic than Toussaint's himself. They were much more resistant to the sort of centralizing dogmas of liberalism. And so I think, in a way, their response was more radical and more subversive, precisely because they did reject the kind of vision of Eurocentricism and French dominance and the French universal. They preferred small farming, and they had their own versions of freedom and their own ideas of how to live their life and what they wanted to do with it, and really weren't that interested in Europe. They wanted whites off the island. They didn't want to continue the plantation economy. They didn't want to keep trading. They didn't want to compete with Britain. They didn't care about any of that stuff. So they really were kind of checking out of the whole game. And I think for them, the call that wasn't meant for them was more an opportunity to step off rather than to sort of engage. You know, it was a way to go to be left alone rather than to sort of finally have the rights. I think in some level, because they were so firm, so clearly below the level of this invitation, that they neither wanted nor expected to be truly invited to this kind of subjectivity.
James Martel is his name. He teaches political science at San Francisco State University. He's the author of a number of books, including a trilogy of books about the philosopher Walter Benjamin. And we are talking about his new book. It's entitled The Misinterpolated Subject. We have a link on againstthegrain.org to James's new book, as well as to his faculty page at SF State. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. And maybe to drive home the point of how important this misinterpolation, this episode of misinterpolation was, could you reflect on the importance of the Haitian Revolution to the subsequent history of revolution and radicalism?
Well, maybe the most important thing to say is that the Haitian Revolution was completely forgotten and ignored as much as possible. I mean, in the Caribbean and in the U.S. South, of course, the Haitian Revolution was celebrated and remembered by people that were continued to be held as slaves because one of their own kind had actually managed to throw off the European slaveholders and powers. But in the West itself, the Haitian Revolution was completely forgotten, deliberately forgotten, and it wasn't until much later, until the mid-20th century and even later still, that it became kind of a well-known subject. So I think it has an incredibly radical message, and it is a very subversive one to liberalism. It really does sort of speak, I think, against rather than for the liberal universal. And that's precisely why I think it was kind of smothered and ignored as much as possible. But as I was saying before, because the Haitian Revolution is arguably the kernel of the radicalism of the French Revolution, and the French Revolution in turn is the kernel of the radicalism of the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, and, you know, revolutions all over the world, it's really kind of fascinating and important to note that it came from such a periphery of the Western world, and it was sort of made the colony itself the kind of the teacher and the sort of way forward by turning everything around. So I think it has this really, really powerful and subversive message for liberal universalism and for colonialism. And furthermore, just for the concept of subjectivity, right? Because if you think of this as a misinterpolated revolution, it's rejecting the colonizing tendencies not only of French colonialism literally in Haiti, but also of the subjectivity that colonizes each of us.
And when you say the Haitian Revolution speaks or spoke against the liberal universal, you mean that it reveals that universal for what it is, which is not universal at all?
Exactly, and how hypocritical it is. But also it has another aspect, which is just as subversive, which is it shows how you can take that bogus message and use it to actually gain power and freedom from colonization.
Right, because you can say, well, I'm doing this because I deserve rights like anyone else.
Exactly. And you can look like a liberal. That's what the thing is. You can use the tools of liberalism and the disguise of liberalism in a way that actually hammers against liberalism. And that's really what I think the real message of the Haitian Revolution and of misinterpolation in general is how to subvert something from inside of it, from deep inside of it, from a place that it's not expecting.
Now, in your book, The Misinterpolated Subject, you give a number of historical and literary examples of misinterpolation. So one of the novels you turn to in your book is Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And the novel's narrator is an unnamed African-American who, as you write, navigates the racist landscape of the U.S. So give us some basics about the novel's plot.
So the narrator, who, as you said, has no name, is trying desperately throughout the earlier parts of the novel in particular to find a place to join in. In other words, to be interpolated. He wants to be interpolated. He wants to find his place in the world. So in the earlier parts of the book, he starts off at a historically black college, and he totally ruins that by driving the white benefactor around to the former slave quarters into a very louche bar and gets in all kinds of trouble, gets expelled. Then he joins up with this organization called the Brotherhood in Harlem, which is clearly based on the American Communist Party, although Ralph Ellison never says that. And here, too, there's a way that he would desperately wants to be seen and recognized and gives himself over completely to the Brotherhood. But the Brotherhood has absolutely no interest in him and just uses him as a pawn for its own purposes. It's run by white people, and they have zero interest in black empowerment. They just are using black people and their own issues and for their own nefarious purposes.
And why is he invisible, or why does he think he's invisible?
He thinks he's invisible because his subjectivity is such that it is kind of given to him in a way that has nothing to do with his own desires and his own wants. And he's kind of given this second-class citizen doesn't even sound like enough. He's like way below second class. He's just sort of nobody. And he doesn't feel like nobody. So there's a kind of the difference between his own internal subjective feelings and the kind of subjecthood he's been given don't seem to mesh very well.
At one point, the narrator of this novel, Invisible Man, he witnesses a police officer murdering a man named Todd Clifton. Who is Clifton and why is he important to the narrator?
So Todd Clifton is another black member of the Brotherhood, and the narrator really sees Clifton as his path to the Brotherhood because Clifton is handsome and he speaks beautifully and he's just really has a real fervor for the Brotherhood himself. So I think the narrator thinks that this man is his path to the Brotherhood himself. And right before Clifton is murdered by the police, he disappears from the Brotherhood. He himself becomes really dissatisfied with the way the Brotherhood treats black people. And he joins this other guy named Ross the Extorter, who's kind of a Marcus Garvey kind of figure, of Pan-Africanist. And the narrator sees Clifton selling these black Sambo dolls on the streets of Harlem. And the Sambo doll is kind of in his eyes, is a kind of a stereotype of black people, and the idea is that if you join the Brotherhood or if you become a liberal, this is what kind of black person you will be. So it's a kind of a insult. And the narrator is heartbroken because he sees this as a betrayal of the very path to the Brotherhood that he thought Clifton was leading him on. And it's just right after that he gets shot and killed.
Okay, so he is killed. In fact, the narrator sees him getting killed. What strikes you about that scene and the narrator's description of it?
So, the main thing about it is just how different it is from the "Hey, you there" that Althusser talks about interpolation. Instead of "Hey, you there," the cop just comes up and kills him. So clearly, there are different treatments by the law of different kinds of subjects, and there's a way in which Clifton wasn't given a chance to turn or say or do anything. He was just murdered. And so that puts the subject of color, and particularly the black subject, into this very peculiar position where they can't even be interpolated or pretend to be interpolated or try to be interpolated if they want to. They're just simply mowed down. And this really has a radicalizing effect on the narrator, and he really changes after that in the book.
James Martel, M-A-R-T-E-L. He's a political scientist based at San Francisco State University. His new book is The Misinterpolated Subject. We'll take a short break and talk more about his book and Ralph Ellison. We'll go on to talk about what Martel thinks of Ta-Nehisi Coates, because he interprets one of Coates' books as well. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. James Martell is my guest in studio. He's a political science professor at San Francisco State University. He teaches courses in political theory, anarchism, post-colonial theory, theories of gender and sexuality, and more. And his new book is called The Misinterpolated Subject. And James, because many people may have joined the program, begun listening to this program after you defined misinterpolation, can you give us a quick definition again?
Sure. Misinterpolation is a term that I use for when interpolation goes awry. And interpolation means when the state gives you your identity or your subjectivity, when the state colonizes you with its own imagined self that it wants you to be, and you become that self. So misinterpolation is resisting that colonization of the self and casting it aside.
Right. The state wants you to be a certain kind of person to facilitate the state's goals.
Exactly.
Okay. So we have this Todd Clifton, this friend of the narrator in Ralph Ellison's novel, Invisible Man, killed by a police officer on the street. Now, the narrator helps plan the funeral given for Todd Clifton. And he gets up, the narrator plans to get up and give a political speech at the event. So what happens?
So he intends to give the kind of speech that the Brotherhood always would have him give, which is to make Clifton into a martyr and somebody who died for the Brotherhood and so forth. But he's kind of transformed by the mood of the crowd, and particularly by these old slave hymns that people are singing. And suddenly he gives a very, very different speech where he completely reverses course and refuses to turn Clifton into a martyr. Instead, he just focuses on his dead body, on his blood, on his physical features, on his shoes and his socks, and just tells a very different story than he intended to.
And what's interesting to you about that? Because there is something very dramatic about, you know, the narrator, if he had done this, getting up in front of this crowd and characterizing, portraying the dead man as a martyr, as a hero.
Right. That's the temptation. And my argument is that had he done so, he would have been effectively contributing to the interpolated subject that everybody wants to be. In other words, he would be turning Clifton into a kind of a black subject who wanted a place at the table, who wanted to be equal to everyone else, and sort of buying into that kind of language and that teleology and that belief in the possibility. And by turning his back on that, I think that's the moment when the narrator himself becomes a misinterpolated subject, when he refuses that kind of identification and he focuses instead on the materiality of Clifton's body, on who he was and what he was doing, and in a way that defies and subverts all those kind of expectations of an interpolated person.
And here in your book, you talk about the complexity of the person, the complexity of Clifton that the narrator is trying to express, trying to describe. Can you talk about that? And how does the complexity contrast with the kind of interpolated subject that, for example, either the state or in this case, maybe even the Brotherhood would want as part of the narrator's identity or Clifton's identity?
Right. So the whole kind of second half of the book is kind of trying to ask the question, who are we when we're busy resisting interpolation? Like, what kind of subjects are we if we're not interpolated subjects? And my argument is that we are, in fact, these kind of vast anarchic interior subjects who have all these different components, some of which are connected to other people, some of which are uniquely our own. We're much more overlapping and complicated and anarchic than we usually understood. And kind of the interpolation of the state is a way of putting an archic subject in control and on top of that anarchic interiority. So my argument in this case is that by treating Clifton in this very material way, talking about his blood and his socks, the narrator is kind of focusing on that kind of anarchic subjectivity as opposed to the kind of failed black subjectivity that he refuses, that's an act of refusing. And by turning his back on that other subjectivity, he becomes more aware or more open to a different kind of subjectivity.
So in other words, the state, for example, the identity it wants to foist on us and often does, it reduces us in a way, right? It's a reduction of who we are. It is a taking of all of our complexity and nuance and turning us into something, or trying to turn us into something uniform.
Exactly. And it's even more pernicious than that in a way, because that's the person that we really believe ourselves to be. because interpolation often does work, and we really think we really are that person. You know, when they say things like, what does your inner voice tell you, or all those kind of things, these are all ways to believe that we really are this one unitary self. And that turns us against the very much more complicated beings that we actually are. These are beings who have races and genders, and these are things that are absolutely, you know, true and real about them. So it's not like we just become this like big internal mush. It's quite the contrary. We become connected materially to the world outside of us and to other people in all these complicated ways. And I think that is a much more radical and anarchic position to act from.
And your definition of anarchism?
It's just a very horizontal kind of way of organizing oneself and to sort of be more accepting of our complexity and our diversity and our internal vastness in a way that all of which is rejected by liberalism, because liberalism wants a pliable individual who it can control and tell them what they want. And in exchange for all this internal complexity, it gives you the individualism of whether you like Pepsi or Coke, you know, so this kind of false choices.
You also find interesting what the narrator's grandfather said to the narrator just before he, the grandfather, died. What did he say?
His grandfather told him that you have to always act like you're a yes man to white people, and you have to act like as if you're going along with them, but you have to fight them with every fiber of your being the whole time, even as you're saying yes.
And what does the narrator take from that?
Well, earlier in his life, he didn't know what to take from that because he still believed and hoped that he could become the kind of person who meant yes. And he wanted to be accepted by the white world, so he wanted to say those things and mean them. It's only like after the funeral, I think, and his change that he starts to think of this as a strategy, as a way to sort of appear quiescent and a good interpolated subject, but actually be something quite different. And one of the beauties of misinterpolation is that when people look at him, they just see a black man, and liberalism knows what that means. It means a certain kind of subject. But he had chosen a different kind of blackness, a different kind of subjectivity. And so what appears as one thing is actually something else, and it gives him this sort of ability to really subvert liberalism from deep within itself. And it doesn't recognize somebody who's refused that recognition because he on the outside appears to be somebody who has been recognized by the state.
But that suggests it's a very private kind of subversion or private kind of radicality. What's the potential, what's the political potential, the community potential, the solidarity potential of that kind of subversiveness?
Well, I think actually that's one of the things I say about the relationship between Clifton and the narrator. It never really gets to happen because it's just budding when Clifton gets murdered. But there's a way in which the narrator finds this other kind of blackness and, in fact, an other kind of brotherhood, not the brotherhood, the communist brotherhood, but a brotherhood with Clifton based on their mutual blackness, which connects them and which puts them into opposition with the brotherhood and allows them to resist its calls as well as resisting liberalism's calls. So I think that in fact, this anarchic interiority can actually connect us much more materially and radically with other people exactly when we understand these kind of cross-cutting forms of identity that are not recognized and are not appreciated and celebrated by the liberal subjectivity. So that's where the politics of this comes in.
Let's turn now, as you do in your book, to Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote a famous book, a very famous book now, called Between the World and Me. And there's a lot in this book. It's framed as an open letter to his teenage son. But at one point, Coates describes the killing by a police officer of his friend, Prince Jones. So how does Coates describe the killing and the funeral and how Coates himself felt at the funeral?
So what was really fascinating to me is that Coates, who is, of course, this is a work of nonfiction. This is something that happened in the real world, and Invisible Man is a literary work. But Coates basically follows the same strategy as the narrator. Because when it comes to the, so first of all, Prince Jones was also a very handsome and, you know, just a wonderful, brilliant black man that Coates really respected and admired. He was actually kind of followed for a long time by this police officer who finally killed him. And at the funeral, you know, it's kind of a Christian funeral, so a lot of people are asking him to forgive the killer, as often happens. And Coates absolutely refuses to do that. And I think that, again, is a moment where he refuses to be the sort of interpolated subject he's expected to be, because forgiveness also buys into this kind of teleological Christian universal worldview in which, you know, everyone gets what they're asking for eventually. Everyone is equal. Everyone is a brother in that sense, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Coates turns his back on that and refuses that and says, forgiveness has no place in this. There's nothing to forgive. This is a white racist system that killed my friend. And forgiving that particular police officer is nothing. There's no point in it. This is just part of a much larger pattern.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. James Martell has a new book out. It's called The Misinterpolated Subject. He teaches political science at San Francisco State University. The narrator in Invisible Man refused to make Clifton, the dead guy, the murdered guy, a hero. Does this happen as well with Coates and Prince Jones?
It does. I mean, he has this wonderful passage, which I think about all the time, where he says, you know, Prince Jones was like a communal effort. Like, he had, you know, music lessons he had to be taken to. He had, like, sandwiches that were made for him. He had clothes that were bought for him. He was just like this amalgamation of so much love and so much work, and it was all just thrown away in like 1 minute. So it was like, you know, he kind of emerges out of this black community, and then he's just randomly destroyed. And I think it has the same effect as when the narrator in Invisible Man describes Clifton's body. He focuses very much on the material aspects, which is a way to counter the kind of phantasmic liberal universal subjectivities that we're always tempted by.
Coates also, in the book, describes slavery to his son. How does he do that?
Now, this is another thing that really struck me as being rather similar to the sort of phenomenon I'm talking about that I saw in Ellison, too, because he says, very importantly to his son, he says, the slaves did not die for you. You are not the redemption of those slaves. Like, your freedom does not make them kind of retroactively redeemed. Because, again, to think that way is to subject the slaves and his son also into this teleological narrative where everything works out in the end, right? That you can do all these terrible things, but everything is kind of constantly advancing and progressing towards this great universal brotherhood. By rejecting that and sort of rejecting the temporal sense of progress, you know, that is so part and parcel of liberal forms of subjectivity, I think Coates is denying like that sense of history, and in that way sort of giving the slaves their own subjectivity again, a different subjectivity, a subjectivity that is unique and is not determined and dictated by like white supremacy.
Also in the book Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates relates an episode in which a white man in a movie theater in Manhattan called out to him in a very disturbing way. What happened?
So Ta-Nehisi Coates' son, who was a toddler at the time, wasn't moving fast enough, and this white woman was getting annoyed with him. So she said something, and then Ta-Nehisi Coates sort of snapped at her. And then this white man, who I don't think knew her, said to him, to Ta-Nehisi Coates, I could have you arrested, which really sort of brought back to Ta-Nehisi Coates the fact that although he felt like he was a black man who was succeeding and maybe this was working out and he was getting his interpolation properly and he was getting his subjectivity, it was a reminder that at any moment he could have been killed and shot just like any other black subject, that he really hadn't achieved the kind of status that he imagined himself to. And it was a kind of another way to sort of turn away from that desire and that temptation to want to be that subject and to try to be a different kind of subject.
Right. He was being interpolated, and it was a question of how he would react to it.
And furthermore, the guy, the white man, wasn't a police officer, so he's being interpolated by just anybody, which sort of shows you that it's not just a police to a pedestrian. It's also like an entire race to another race has that kind of interpolating power as well.
You quote Coates writing in his book, Between the World and Me. I'm going to read it. Perhaps struggle is all we have because the God of history is an atheist, and nothing about his world is meant to be. So you must wake up every morning knowing that no promise is unbreakable, least of all the promise of waking up at all. This is not despair. These are the preferences of the universe itself, verbs over nouns, actions over states, struggle over hope. How do you interpret that?
I'm not sure what Ta-Nehisi Coates himself would think of this, but I read it as a very, very anarchist statement. That it's anarchist because it is, like, again, rejecting teleology. It's rejecting a sense of progress. It's rejecting the promise that time or the world owes you anything. And it's sort of the idea that you have to take these things for yourself and you have to make these things true, not just as an individual, but collectively as well. So I think it's really turning his back on kind of senses of destinies and fates and determinations and all these kind of things, and sort of seeing struggle not as this kind of, like he says, it's not despair, but it's also not hope either, because I think hope can be very poisonous. I think hope is what keeps people strung along with this promise of some big liberal payoff in the end. So he sort of avoids both hope and despair, I think, in that phrase. And I think that is very anarchist. It's neither. It's like, we're going to do what we can do. Let's see what happens.
So you write that misinterpolation is a principal way that radical change happens in a world dominated by global capitalism and liberal ideology. Now, that strikes me as a very strong statement, because you could say, well, misinterpolation sometimes happens and it might have varying effects and sometimes the effect is quite strong. But you are saying it's a principal way that radical change happens. Talk about that.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I think every moment of interpolation is also a moment of misinterpolation. So there's always the potential in every time. And as you said earlier, too, we are being interpolated constantly. It's a constantly reinforcing. It's not a one-time thing. We're constantly being reinterpolated over and over again. So there's always this potential for really strong radical resistance. And I think that those instances when the interpolation in the liberal society fails and breaks down comes from this potential, from realizing this potential one way or the other. I don't necessarily want to go out on a limb and say it's the only way that radical change can happen, but I think it's something that liberalism is uniquely susceptible to, exactly because of the status of the universal under liberalism and the way that it's always demanding a kind of subjectivity from us, and that it's vulnerable because, like I said earlier, the state needs us to recognize it. We don't need it to recognize us. And so it's very lopsided. In that sense, it's always vulnerable to this kind of collapse from these kind of moments of subversion.
But don't we yearn in some sense for the state to recognize us so that we can have the rights and privileges that it promises us?
Yes, but that's where it gets really interesting. We yearn for that with the subjectivity that the state gave us. So the state tells us we're really these people who really want the state. And as long as we think that's true, then we do. But the minute we realize we're also other things, even as this is going on, that's the part of us that doesn't yearn for that. And that's why we're able to respond and reject the state's seductions.
How inevitable is it that we realize that we are not the people that the state wants us to be? In other words, we're held in thrall by the state to some degree and its ideology and its propaganda. So is it possible to you that somebody could just live their whole lives without really understanding the radical nature of their subjectivity, or I should say the how different their subjectivity really is compared with what is being foisted upon them by the state?
Oh, unfortunately, I think that's majority of the time. I think most of us do that. And I think even the most radical people live the majority of their life that way. It's easier. It seems safer. It's like it's what you want. You really do have these desires. I mean, interpolation works to the extent that we really do want these things. We want other things too, but we also really want that. So it's very painful to turn away from that. It's very disappointing, you're giving up on everything, and it just seems like such a scary thing to do. But that's why I feel like thinking more about the positive nature of our anarchic interiority is really exciting and fulfilling, because it makes us realize that we've also been these other subjects that want different things and have different things going on. So it's not an either or. It's not like Margaret Thatcher says, there is no alternative. There is an alternative. It's actually generated from within the context of liberalism itself.
Does your book discuss ways in which individual misinterpolated subjects might connect up with each other in concrete ways such that a kind of political solidarity or movement might occur?
Very much so. So especially in the parts of the book where I analyze actual political movements, like the Haitian Revolution being one that we talked about, is very much about the kind of the ideas these people show up to answer a call that they think is for them, and then they find out it's not for them, and they're all standing there, and then they have a decision. What do we do? Do we all like slink away and feel bad about ourselves, or do we align with each other in our anger and our hostility and work that out and against a common enemy? And I think that's an opportunity. It doesn't always work out, of course, but the realization of misinterpolation is always an opportunity to sort of fight against a common enemy. And I have one more. I'll give you another quick example that I talk about in the book, which is when Woodrow Wilson gave his call for self-determination of nations at the end of World War I and during the 14-point speech, what he was talking about was white empires in Europe casting off like the Hohenzollerns and the Habsburgs and all those people. But what people heard in Egypt and Vietnam and China and Japan and, they heard something different. They said, hey, this is great. We want self-determination too. So they actually all came to Versailles for this conference where none of them were invited. And they showed up and they were treated terribly, of course, because nobody wanted them there. And that's when the radicalized anti-colonial third world movement really began. So that's another example of people coming together when they all realize this common humiliation that they were not invited. They showed up, but they were not invited. And then it's the determination to stay and demand those rights anyway that I think is the radical next step after misinterpolation happens.
To what extent is your goal with this book, The Misinterpolated Subject, to increase the occurrences of misinterpolation, or to have misinterpolation, you know, when it happens, move more often in a kind of radical or lasting direction?
I think both are important. I think the book basically just points to a vulnerability, and I think it's kind of an invitation to think, you know, more about how vulnerable the state is, because I think people are scared, and rightfully so, of the state. But I see when you realize how vulnerable it is, how much it needs to be recognized, and how it'll return to its own nothingness if it's not given that recognition, how this is a real power that people, that subjects of the state have that they don't always recognize. So part of it is just that. And furthermore, it's just like a sort of an invitation to think more about our anarchic interiority and to sort of think about an anarchism that goes from all the way down, as I like to say, like from the kind of the collective to the internal, you know, sort of anarchist at all levels and in all ways.
You also look at the origins in Tunisia of what became called the Arab Spring. So in what way do you see this as an example of misinterpolation?
So in the case of the Arab Spring, you're kind of dealing with a decaying universal, because Tunisia was still somewhat under the influence of the French universal, and there was still some aspect of believing in this universal, however much it was revealed to be completely false for Tunisians. And so Mohamed Bouazizi, who is the sort of the man who immolated himself at the start of the Arab Spring, it's a very, very well-known story. He was like humiliated in public, and he went to the local government office demanding justice, and they laughed at him and they treated him badly. And I think something snapped in him, because he realized, you know, I have been living with this belief that I will get some kind of justice, and I just clearly never will. And that's when he set himself on fire. And I think a lot of other people recognize that same response. That I think this is why it ignited the Arab Spring in a way, because, you know, they saw in his refusal to any longer be that subject that they too would refuse to be that subject. And I think that's how things started. And of course, that inspired Occupy Wall Street and our current round of radicalism. So I think misinterpolation keeps happening, you know, whether people like it or not.
James Martell, professor of political science at San Francisco State University. We have a link on our website, againstthegrain.org, to his faculty page at San Francisco State, as well as to his new book that we have been discussing this hour. It's called The Misinterpolated Subject, and it's published by Duke University Press. James, a pleasure talking with you again. Thanks for writing this book.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.